Critically Linked, How Books of the Past Shape Our Future, a DiscourseNet podcast with Dana Triff and Jaspal Singh.
Hi, my name is Dana Triff and...
My name is Jaspal Singh.
And we are the hosts of Critically Linked, a podcast that wishes to refocus public discussion on old and sometimes new philosophers. We ask our guests how relevant these ideas are for the many challenges we face today. In our previous episodes, we have discussed Immanuel Kant's 18th century universalism and how it fits or does not fit with Jamaican philosophers Charles W. Mill's Black Radical Kantianism. We also aimed our arrows at John Stuart Mill's The Subjection of Women, an essay he published in 1859. And we asked ourselves if the woman question was still relevant today. Well, in short, the answer was yes. Now we turn our attention to a philosopher who somehow falls in between the categories of old and new. Ernesto Laclau, Argentinian, born in 1935, leftist activist and sympathizer, has taught for many years in the Department of Government at the University of Essex, where he co-founded and directed the Center for Ideology and Discourse Analysis. He wrote many books and scientific articles. His chef-d'oeuvre, however, Hegemonian Socialist Strategy Towards a Radical Democratic Politics, was published in 1985, in the early stages of his career. He co-wrote this book with his longtime partner, Belgian philosopher Chantal Mouffe. Together with us today are Eva Herschinger, a discourse analyst and security expert at the Center for Intelligence and Security Studies at the University of the German Federal Armed Forces in Munich, also author of Constructing Global Enemies, Hegemony and Identity in International Discourses on Terrorism and Drug Prohibition, one of the first books bringing Laclau's thinking to international relations. Eva writes and teaches on international security topics, and some of her latest work has also focused on patterns of radicalization and gendered security. Welcome, Eva.
Thank you for having me.
The second guest, Thomas Jacobs, assistant professor at the Université Saint-Louis in Brussels. Thomas is also a discourse analyst interested in Laclau's concept of hegemony as well as in European politics. He has very recently published a book, Hegemony, Discourse and Political Strategy Towards a Post-Marxist Understanding of Contestation and Politicization, with academic publisher John Benjamin. Thomas analyzes in his book a specific policy field in European politics, EU trade law, and works with some of Laclau's key concepts. He also teaches and has research interests in communication, public relations, and media. Hello, Thomas.
Hey, Dana. Hey, Jaspal. It's super wonderful to be here.
Great. So Ernesto Laclau's landmark writing in post-Marxist thinking has given us many enduring keywords such as antagonism, hegemony, the logic of equivalence, and the logic of difference. It has also forcefully argued the case for the ubiquity of power and politics in all social relations. Society, Laclau argued, was not a closed project, but always an open one. Hegemony and Socialist Strategy was published in 1985, as Dana said, so only 4 years before the fall of communism in Eastern Europe and the disintegration of the Soviet Union. A new international society appeared back then. Laclau and his partner Mouffe had programmatically distanced themselves from Marxist philosophy and politics. Drawing substantially on Michel Foucault's thinking, their book attempted to show how leftist thinking can flourish in a democratic society that reinvents itself, and how new ideological discourses emerge and wane. With hindsight, the book may have wanted to untangle ideology from authoritarian politics and show us that antagonisms are inevitable, but their effects are not predetermined. Yet, a bit less than 40 years later, we see ourselves confronted with a war in Ukraine, in which 1989, as perhaps an empty signifier, has been invoked as a major political catastrophe that never should have happened. Today, we witness a proliferation of conflicts and a worsening of democratic quality in some of the oldest liberal democratic political systems, including the United States. Donald Trump, who has come to represent the far-right populist politician by excellence, announced last month that he would seek the Republican presidential nomination in 2024. Coming back to one of Laclau's key concepts, antagonism, I would like to ask you, what can Laclau's philosophy still teach us? What is antagonism? How is it related to identity? And are we doomed, paraphrasing him, to antagonize each other? Ifa, do you want to kick off?
Yeah. Starting with this question of what can Laclau's philosophy still teach us, apart from having lovely memories of him with singing the Internationale or International at conferences and at the conference dinner and taking each other's hands and standing around the tables and singing this song. That's definitely something he can teach us, in the sense of a theory is always fulfilled with memories and emotions and the way we approach them. So I have also very, somehow an emotional relation with this or connection to this theory. But apart from that, I think, or for me, in a nutshell, Laclau teaches us that political struggle and negotiation are at the heart of defining and constituting political communities. It is about how these struggles are negotiated and how we deal with these struggles, whether we consider them legitimate or whether we consider the outcome as legitimate. And I think that also explains a bit the relationship between antagonism and identity you alluded to in your question. Because, I mean, antagonism, to put it very casually, one could say it is that part of ourselves that we don't like, or that we would like to overcome. That's very casually put. And to put it in Laclau's or Laclau, as it is pronounced in Argentinian, I was told once, to put it in their terms, it would be the presence of the other prevents me from being fully myself. And of course, it's not about us, about individuals. It's about the relationship between the subject and discourse. But perhaps it explains a bit what antagonism is about. Antagonism's objective being is a symbol of my non-being. Antagonism is at the same time the possibility and the impossibility of a subject. So we need antagonism to become a subject, but also we would like to overcome it. In that way, antagonism could be a symbol or a chiffre for democratic politics in a way, but we'll come to that later probably. And with regard to political communities, now coming to the identity aspect, it means that society will always have within itself antagonism and a social division and opposition. So the problem with antagonism, if I might already say that, because I'm going to come back on that probably a million times, political actions will, of course, be conducted with this illusion that these actions can overcome the antagonistic force and we become our full selves, our better selves, in a way. I'm already saying this is an illusion because, as I said before, it is that part of ourselves we cannot overcome, but we try, our political actions try to overcome it. Perhaps something I picked up by Michael Dillon, one of those IR scholars, political theorists, a very influential one. He just wrote one time, it's about acknowledging the uncanny other in ourselves. And I think that's a very good way to have a different perspective on antagonism. On the one hand, what I like about Laclau's idea of identity is he very clearly said, we cannot do without identity. We have to identify. We cannot live in a monadic existence. We have to identify with something. Therefore, I had a lot of discussions when writing the book you nicely mentioned, Dana, in the introduction. Is it more about identity, or should I talk about identification, to be honest? So I would say, in hindsight, yeah, it would probably be better to speak about identification, because this process, the dynamics, very much more is in sync with what Laclau and Mouffe later on also wrote. So identity and antagonism are linked, as you want to have a full-fledged identity, and in order to get to this identity, you have to overcome antagonism. So the antagonism is the thing that stands in the way to become your identity. The thing is, as you asked, Jasper, about whether we are doomed and is there any way to overcome antagonism, we're not doomed, I would say. Laclau himself wrote, I think, in the New Reflections on the Revolutions of Our Time in 1990, in that book, he explained that antagonism is not a teleological aim in identity construction, or of identity construction, sorry. So it has not to be an antagonistic other. There are varying degrees of otherness that are thinkable, though one will always be somehow the more antagonistic than other. So we probably come to that point where we talk about in how far is there a way to overcome it. So, but we're not doomed. As I said before, it's about negotiation and deliberation. And the thing is, political struggles do not have a predetermined outcome in the theory of Laclau. So, and it's the same about identity. So fundamental antagonisms cannot always be avoided. And of course, it's difficult to think of political orders without any limits. However, the constitutive nature, I would argue, in the theory, does not mean that dissent and conflict are simply given. Rather, they are subject to negotiation.
Great, thank you. Thomas, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Jasper. I always, with my students, when we read Laclau, I always like going back to the pages in Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, just before he introduces the concept of antagonism, where he talks about, first he talks about difference, you know, material states, they can be different from one another. I'm currently sitting in a room, and outside of the window, there is the outside. Obviously, these two things, they're different from one another. Concepts, like Laclau explains, they can be opposed to each other. Let's say the concept of natural, and then you have the concept of unnatural, that's its opposite. You have the concept beautiful, and then you have ugly, that's its opposite. The way I like to, on a very basic level, introduce antagonism to my students is by explaining that antagonism, in the thinking of Laclau, it takes these notions of difference, opposition, contrariety, and it blows them up to proportion, that the only thing that still exists is this difference, is this opposition. Antagonism is a form of difference, a form of opposition that really eliminates all other modes of being. There is only left this crucial central antagonism, and the entire space of signification is dominated by this one big division, with at its center, like Laclau's perhaps most famous concept, the empty signifier. In American politics, around the empty signifier of democracy, you have the Republicans and you have the Democrats. And this antagonism, it dominates the entire sphere of politics. There's nothing outside of it. In the imagination of far-right extremists, you have on the one side them, the good guys, and on the other side you have the globalists. And this is, you know, the big combat of our times. There's nothing else that exists, nothing else matters within this political space. And I think these examples illustrate to a certain extent what Eva referred to when she talked about how powerful antagonism can be as a mechanism for constructing identities, as a mechanism for political identification. I think antagonisms are one of the most important ways in which we construct our political identities. I am something because I'm opposed to something else, because I combat this other political force. However, I think, you know, returning to your question of are we doomed to antagonize, I think if you read Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, and this was your only introduction to the work of Laclau, I think indeed you might be forced to think so. I think in Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, Laclau and Mouffe really talk about antagonism as, you know, the political force that dominates all others. They talk about it as, you know, the ontological mechanism through which your social is constructed. The social comes into being through antagonism. Eva referred to the book New Reflections on the Revolution of Our Time. And I think in that book, Laclau and Mouffe, 5 years later, they kind of, Laclau himself, he implicitly, I don't think he writes it explicitly, but he implicitly admits to a certain extent, well, I was wrong in a certain sense to see antagonism as the only ontological mechanism through which identities come into being. There is, of course, the dislocation of the social. We do still believe that social construction is not a teleological process, that it's an open-ended process. And antagonisms definitely have a strong role to play in there. But they're not the only representative force, not the only mechanism of representation through which political identities come into being. And in that sort of sense, I would also, you know, argue that we are not doomed to antagonize each other. Antagonisms are an incredibly powerful political tool, which have, and they have been deployed recently with incredible success by various political actors. However, I don't think we're doomed to only ever conduct politics in an antagonistic fashion. And I think to a certain extent, particularly the later Laclau, would agree with that sentiment.
I am, for one, glad that both of you are quite positive about us not being doomed to reproduce this logic always and ever. Let's give Laclau, though, the word as well. And I'm going to quote from the book we have mentioned. He says, antagonism as the negation of a given order is, quite simply, the limit of that order. And the limit of the social must be given within the social itself, as something subverting it, destroying its ambition to constitute a full presence. Society never manages to fully be society, because everything in it is penetrated by its limits, which prevent it from constituting itself as an objective reality. So I want to shift a little bit the perspective here and ask you, could it be that authoritarianism itself is a longing for disclosure, for a closed, fixed society, for an unmoving society? And if so, to end all antagonisms, could this be a slip towards authoritarianism? And would this slip be inevitable?
I would definitely agree with you, Dana, that to a certain extent, authoritarianism is indeed a response to this longing for closure, to this desire for closure, and to this need to, you know, gloss over and hide the fact that the social universe can never be completely neatly crystallized the way the structuralist would have had it. And antagonism, you know, it can, like Laclau says, precisely be a symptom of the fact that the social universe can never be fully closed. There is always going to be ruptures. There's always going to be fault lines that remain, and we can never arrive at this neatly, perfectly crystallized social constellation. Antagonism can be a symptom of this, and then authoritarianism in this context can precisely be a way to hide the fact that the social will always be dislocated. Authoritarianism can be understood as a force that can do away with antagonisms. I think in the most authoritarian societies in the world, part of what makes them so totalitarian is the complete impossibility of articulating any form of political antagonism, articulating any form of political difference. They have at least created the illusion of some sort of a perfect society in which no fault lines exist anymore. And so in that sort of sense, I would think of antagonism as a positive political force. Antagonism can be a force with which we can fight political authoritarianism. Then again, of course, on the other hand, many forms of authoritarianism depend on very explicitly articulated forms of antagonism, where certain social groups, where certain ethnic groups, or certain political groups are really seen as the antagonistic other, who is to be uprooted, and they are the ones that stand in the way of the realization of our ideal dreamed society. And in this sort of a discourse, of course, antagonism is no longer a force with which to fight authoritarianism, but it's rather a way through which authoritarian discourses legitimate the fact, justify the fact that even in this authoritarian society, somehow we have not managed to create a perfect society without any dislocations. The fact that there are still dislocations left in all of society, it is to be blamed on this antagonistic other, whether it be the socialists, whether it be the Democrats, in certain very, very racist forms of political discourse, it has been various ethnic groups. And in the hands of this sort of a discourse, antagonism is, of course, no longer a positive political force, but it becomes rather a force for very naked forms of political violence. So I do think that this whole reflection on the link between authoritarianism and antagonism is really interesting. And it's perhaps one that in the scientific literature on this topic hasn't been completely explored to its full extent, I would think.
So if authoritarianism is a utopia in a sense, and it is meant to be undermined by existing antagonisms in society anyway, is this then a positive message that the contradictions in authoritarianism itself will at some point lead to its demise? Or is it perhaps the wrong question in a sense when thinking back on what antagonism in society, the role it actually plays?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the wrong question. Perhaps one needs to go back and think whether Laclauan movement antagonism to be so exclusively about democratic societies. And I think when you read hegemony and socialist strategy, you would say it's for any kind of society. I would argue that I very much agree with what you said, Thomas. And I would even say that if you make this difference between the political systems, they all need antagonisms one way or the other. It's more about how open they deal with their antagonisms. In democracy, probably obviously more open, whereas, as you've just outlined, Thomas, in authoritarian systems, they try to conceal the divisions, the struggles that are still there. I mean, if you look at the current situation in China, for instance, we all see that there are divisions, there are struggles that question the political leadership and the structure of the system. Iran would be another example of what we currently witness. So antagonism is something any system needs, but handles differently. And I think in democracies, we are more, one could say before Trump, we've been more apt in dealing with antagonisms now. Nowadays, I don't know. We'll talk about that for sure. But I think it's about this, how it is played in the open, in the discourse, in whether it's acknowledged and whether groups are allowed to speak in Laclauian terms, to voice their demands and to gather and establish changes, chains of equivalence. Talk about that in a minute, probably. To create forces that are potentially bringing up counter-hegemonic demands. So I think that, for me, that would be a difference, because irrespective of if authoritarianist systems are trying to create an illusion of a lovely society, everyone has its place. To end all antagonism is quite foolish in a way. You have to deal with that in Laclauian terms, and I would subscribe to that. So it's not about striving to overcome it, but as Thomas also said, it's how we deal with it.
Eva, you have recently worked on radicalization in Germany, and authoritarianism plays a role in radicalization, of course. So why do you think authoritarianism still has an appeal, particularly perhaps in Germany with the past, with our past, where authoritarianism is very much sort of in our, within our historical awareness. And are there any gender differences on this issue?
Yeah, authoritarianism offers something democracy doesn't, I would say. It has a fixed place for everyone. It appears to be neat. So no struggles, no contestations, at least not that much. There's one strong man, and yeah, it's always a man. There are rarely women who is fighting off all dangers. And from the inside, from the outside, you have a clear view of your enemies, which are always outside most of the time. And if there are inside enemies, they always have ties to the external enemies. So, and you have to act accordingly. And if you know your place, you're safe, so to say. And as you mentioned, Germany and the appeal in particular in Germany, let me give you an example of the recent polls that are since two decades. A group of researchers from Leipzig are doing a study which is called the Leipziger Autoritarismusstudie, the Leipziger Authoritarian Study. And they try to analyze with their studies, with their polls, how specific aspects of right-wing thinking and mindsets have been present for the last 20 years in Germany. One of the questions is, do we need a new authoritarian Führer in current politics? So they even use this word. And they found that right-wing extremist attitudes overall have declined, in some cases significantly. At the same time, the hatred of migrants, women, Muslims, and other groups in Germany has increased. They have also witnessed in the data that there's an increased desire for authority as a result of the pandemic. Probably not very surprising. But where radicalization comes in is exactly here, namely, in particular, in Germany, right-wing ideologies, they offer the kind of things I've just outlined authoritarian systems, political thinking offers. Clear view on friend and foe, capitalizing on fears, and energy images like migrants, feminists as well. So, and if you subscribe to these divisions, you get respect, you get recognition, you find a group of like-minded people you can belong to, and you find a new sense in life. So that's in a nutshell why there is a certain appeal of these ideologies. And in this respect, antagonism becomes your raison d'être. You would never want to overcome it because it gives your ideology an edge, a constant movance to search for the absolute enemy, to quote one of the other titles of one of the other articles of Laclau. And gendered, it is in many ways, as these relationship between the sexes and the power involved in these relationships are obviously at stake here. Said before that everyone has its his and her place, and it's a binary world. It's a world of men and women. With, very briefly put, men in the dominant position and women in the inferior position. So things are very clear. You don't need a feminist leaders or any kind of these to fight for your emancipation. So it's nothing else, it's binary. And any non-binary thinking endangers this, yeah, the thinking and this gendered world. So homogeneity is key. And as a result, we have homogeneous identities. Binary identities just come out, and they are obviously very easily put into work towards antagonizing others that are non-binary, that open up the space for any other kind of sexual orientation.
So I think what I take from your response, Eva, is that we can actually become increasingly comfortable in our certainties, in our antagonisms. We don't wish to overcome them. And I do, in fact, have a perfect example for a process which seems to be going in that direction. And interestingly enough, is in one of the oldest liberal democracies that we know, the United States. Competition between the Democrats, right, and the Republicans seems to be getting ever more antagonistic. They seem to be getting very comfortable with opposing each other, up to the point where being a Democrat means being not a Republican. So, Thomas, would you agree a little bit with this characterization? Is this competition, political competition in the US, increasingly becoming more antagonistic? What about the race in Pennsylvania between John Fetterman and celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz? Would you say this is representative for the state of the American democracy? What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, American politics is, I think, obviously, I very much agree with you, in a far more antagonistic state than it was, say, 30, 40 years ago, when there was the happy center with Bill Clinton and all big differences seemed to have been resolved. And bipartisanism was the watchword of the day. That era is clearly over. We have now reached an era where antagonisms are absolutely maximized. There's definitely no question of there being, you know, honest, agonistic competition between respecting opponents, like Mouffe would have it in her ideal democracy. That's definitely not what we see in America right now. Debates are far more antagonistic. And to a certain extent, I would feel like right now the situation in American politics betrays, to a certain extent, the limits of what like Mouffe calls agonistics, of respecting your opponent, of making sure that even though there are clear differences, we still remain competitors rather than enemies. In that you still have some politicians, particularly within the Democratic Party, who continue to believe in bipartisanship, who continue to believe that the Republican Party will somehow return to normal. And we get into this situation where a Democrat says, well, I believe that there are still reasonable people left in the Republican Party who I differ with, but who have reasonable ideas that are worthy of a discussion. And the next person speaking is the leader of the Republican caucus in some regional, some state Congress, yelling that Hillary Clinton ran a pedophile ring in a pizzeria in New York. This sort of a stark, you know, situation to a certain extent reveals on the one hand the strength of an antagonistic strategy, because the latter discourse, of course, completely ridiculizes the former discourse. And it also betrays to a certain extent, I think, the limits of Mouffe's agonistics. That is not to say that all successful politicians in America are deploying an antagonist strategy. I think, for instance, somebody who ran a very, very antagonistic campaign in the Laclauian sense of the word was Hillary Clinton. Her main proposition, I think, was the fact that she was not Donald Trump. I think that was the main reason why she thought people would vote for her. I am not Donald Trump. Her entire political identity was based on antagonism with the figure of Donald Trump. And I think to a certain extent that strategy betrayed its limits in the sense that that made her chain of equivalence, the coalition that she could gather around her, chain of equivalence in which people could inscribe themselves with the subject positions available within her campaign, it was rather narrow, because, you know, you kind of had to be incredibly opposed to the figure of Donald Trump to be able to identify with her, which, as it so turned out in a couple of key states such as Michigan and Pennsylvania, people were not feeling that way. People were not necessarily themselves antagonistically opposed to Donald Trump. And by basing her entire political identity on an antagonism towards him, she narrowed her political coalition, as it so turned out, too much. On the flip side, we also have examples available of politicians employing strategies, political strategies, other than antagonism, and being rather successful in this. I think Joe Biden has made far more of a positive offer towards the American people than Hillary Clinton did during her presidential campaign. And he, as it so turned out, was more successful. The chain of equivalence of his campaign was far more broad and far more encompassing. He was many more things than not Donald Trump. And perhaps his antagonism towards Donald Trump was part of his strategy, but his strategy was definitely not excluded, not exclusively based on this antagonism. And I think that the political race to which you recently referred is actually a great example of, I think, the limits of antagonism to a certain, to a certain degree, in that on the one hand, you had this celebrity doctor, Republican, not very much of a politician, not a lot of content, and his main offer was that he was against the Democrats. He was against, this silly Democrat across him, he was very much opposed to him. On the other side, you had the Democratic candidate, John Fetterman, who at the start of the campaign had suffered a stroke and who was clearly, throughout the campaign, still heavily recovering from this stroke. And you could see that, for instance, his speech was to a certain extent impaired by this stroke. And so on the one hand, you had this guy, Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, yelling, "I'm not like you, I'm opposed to you," very antagonistically saying this. And on the other side, you had John Fetterman, whose strategy was far less antagonistic and who was far more, his campaign was far more turned towards the Pennsylvanian people, saying, "Look, I'm just a regular guy. Yeah, I am Joe Public. I'm the man in the street. Your struggles are mine. You struggle with your health. I struggle with my health. I'm very much a normal guy like you." And this strategy, of course, perfectly countered Mehmet Oz's strategy of being very antagonistic. Joe Fetterman tells the American people, tells the Pennsylvanian people, "I'm just like you. I'm just a regular guy. I'm just like you." And Mehmet Oz tells John Fetterman, "I'm not like you. I'm completely opposite to you. I am the stellar opposite of you." Of course, that led to a big, somehow a disjoint, in that Mehmet Oz was regarded as very much out of tune, not in step with the regular Pennsylvanian people. They regarded him as being, this outsider, not one of us. And despite it having been announced as sort of a battleground state, John Fetterman, with his non-antagonistic strategy, rather easily beat Mehmet Oz, who was employing this antagonistic strategy. So to wrap up a little bit, I would say that even though American politics are becoming ever more antagonistic, I do believe, I don't think antagonism is the only political strategy available which politicians can have success in the American context, but the same goes in the European context or elsewhere.
I just would really like to underline what Thomas just said about antagonism being not a political, even perhaps not a very effective and not very successful strategy. Because the examples are really manifold for it being a rather unsuccessful strategy in many ways. I'm just thinking about terrorism, international terrorism, that has not been defined. I wrote this book about it, so it perfectly aligns with what you just said. It's not sufficient to say this is our enemy and then just direct, as you said, Hillary, "I'm not Trump, I'm even a woman, so I'm definitely not Trump." It's not sufficient. And I think that is what I would say as a political message from Laclau and the antagonism discussion is, it's not sufficient to rely on singling out somebody else or a system or whatever and use this as a strategy to achieve political consensus or a majority. It is hollow. I sometimes don't understand why a number of politicians fall for it. I mean, it's very easy. It's very nicely done. In Germany, we can see it's done in particular by those who are not too democratic or at the fringes. But I think that's a very important point you said, just Thomas. It's not sufficient to have just an as big as an enemy as it might be. You still have to have a political program, and in best like Biden, a more positive outlook.
Yeah, can I just come in very quickly here before we go on to the next topic? Because I've been following these arguments that you made there with great interest, and I'm really fascinated with this idea that we can have a mechanism like antagonism to actually untangle this and like to sort of make sense of modern day politics. But isn't what about the concept of identity politics here? We had Obama, right, who was as an African-American president, the first African-American, although that might not actually be fully true if you go down the history books and read them carefully. Some others actually also were African or at least semi-African heritage. But we had Obama as this kind of new person who would sort of shake up all of American politics. And then we had to have a woman, right? We had to have Hillary Clinton in some ways to come forward and say, okay, like now I'm going to change everything. And maybe Kamala Harris combines those two, right? As a Black woman, right? So there is identity politics. We see identity politics play out in the Conservative Party in Britain at the moment, right, which is the most diverse cabinet that is ever there, right, which is paradoxical. And we talked about identity earlier. So in some ways, it's maybe not enough to just look at coalitions and antagonism and political strategy, but we also have to focus on the person and the persona of who these people represent and just think about, you know, how identity and hegemony and antagonism all sort of influence each other and sort of sometimes perhaps play each other out, if that makes sense. You know, so you might have the right political strategy, but the wrong persona. And perhaps Hillary Clinton was just too much of an establishment person, maybe the history of Bill Clinton like cheating on her, you know, with Monica Lewinsky did something to the American psyche that wouldn't allow the American public to vote for her or something like that. There are all these kind of complex dimensions to identity that you know that complexify our ideas of hegemony and antagonism.
Maybe the challenge here is really to see identity, as Eva mentioned in the beginning, as a process of identification. Thomas has already mentioned a logic of equivalence, has already explained, in a sense, how Fetterman managed to create his image as one of the people. But of course, I mean, he filled this image as the man of the people with content. And one of the things Laclau teaches us is that in order to do that, you have to employ this logic of equivalence. Yeah? And I wanted to discuss a little bit this concept because he then contrasts it with another logic of difference. And both of them are very significant in the ways discourses then become hegemonic. And very briefly put, a hegemonic discourse is a winning political coalition. So maybe the challenge for us, in a sense, to understand Laclau, to read Laclau, is to understand how politics functions and to read his concepts by looking at these very practical examples of politics. I have an example taken from Laclau, which builds, in a sense, on everything that we have spoken so far and the way this identity is created, the way this process of identification takes place. And I chose it also because it's one of the few instances in which Laclau discusses the process of colonization, of decolonization. So let's see how we can disentangle a little bit this logic of equivalence and the logic of difference, and what do they do to coalition building, to identity building. So says Laclau, the colonizer is discursively constructed as the anti-colonized, with a relation of equivalence absorbing all the positive determinations of the colonizer, dress, behavior, etc., in opposition to the colonized. And the political space in this way is divided into two, So the logic of equivalence simplifies political space by dividing it into two camps. On the other hand, however, we have the logic of difference. And again, I would like to quote Laclau here. We thus see that the logic of equivalence is a logic of simplification of political space, while the logic of difference is a logic of its expansion and increasing complexity. Taking a comparative example from linguistics, we could say that the logic of difference tends to expand the syntagmatic pole of language, the number of positions that can enter into a relation of combination and hence of continuity with one another, while the logic of equivalence expands the paradigmatic pole, that is, the elements that can be substituted for one another, thereby reducing the number of positions which can possibly be combined, end quote. So how do we create a persona? How do we create a winning coalition by linking all these different demands through the logic of equivalence? How do we break apart authoritarian discourses or authoritarian challenges by employing the logic of difference?
I think that the logic of difference and the logic of equivalence are probably two of my I think they're two of the most powerful concepts that Laclau proposes. They are so polyvalent, they are so flexible, you know, without reifying Laclau's theory as some sort of a, you know, materialist physics of how politics works. I really think they go to the level of the, you know, prime, the most basic forces of how politics works. I think the example of the colonizer is an incredibly powerful example there of how the logic of equivalence works as a political force. You might, you know, imagine yourself in 18th century England, and you've just moved to the city, you've moved to Manchester, because the farm on which you were working has been replaced by this, you know, it has been enclosed upon, and you know, your local agricultural business no longer works, so you move to the city and you don't have a dime to you know, to even feed your children. You are the true Marxist proletariat. And yet, when we think about global politics at that time, we so easily imagine this person to be part of the same coalition, to be part of the same, you know, political team as the rich aristocrat who has ships full of gold coming across the Atlantic, coming into Birmingham, and who, you know, who counts the shiploads rather than the dimes that he has. We think of these two as being on the same team. And that is because the logic of equivalence at play within the block of the colonizer and opposing this block antagonistically to the other block of the colonized is so powerful. You know, colonized nations, which themselves are incredibly complex entities with large, you know, class differences, you know, all sorts of differences that exist within these two blocks, they're being erased by this incredibly powerful logic of equivalence. So now we were just in the 18th century or in the 17th, 16th century, we're discussing colonialism. Let's move to today and the crisis of Marxism, the decline of social democracy. I think that one of the most intuitive ways in which we can understand this decline of social democracy is the logic of equivalence that for a long time kept the socialist bloc together, weakening, being impinged upon by various logics of difference that get articulated. I think that for a long time, the social democratic bloc consisted of, on the one hand, young people, intellectuals, working class people, people in very different material situations, people with very different backgrounds, and yet they all find themselves within this one coalition, kept together by the logic of equivalence of socialism. And part of the success of the populist movement, part of the success of the radical right, is that it has, you know, articulated the logic of difference, kind of splitting off the working class from this coalition. The logic of equivalence that kept the working class as part of the socialist coalition is becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. And I think if we, you know, if today we hear all of this ranting about woke, the dangers of woke, a couple of years ago, it was cultural Marxism. Somehow that one has disappeared. Maybe it was, you know, it had slightly too many anti-Semitic connotations. I don't know why, but it has somehow disappeared. I think, you know, these notions of cultural Marxism, of woke, they're part of an incredibly powerful logic of difference that tries to, you know, create some sort of a complexity, create some sort of a nuance create somehow a problematic situation within the former left-wing coalition. Because, of course, students, liberals, in the classic sense, in the American sense of the word, progressives might think very differently of, you know, the political issues that are invoked with terms like cultural Marxism, terms like woke. Working class people will think very differently about that. And so I think the reason why people like Elon Musk, Donald Trump love ranting about woke is because they recognize that it's a powerful political strategy. It's a powerful logic of difference that can, you know, loosen a crucial part of the progressive coalition from this former hegemonic bloc. And so I think what these examples illustrate is that the notions of logic and difference and logic of equivalence, as they exist in Laclauian theory, they're incredibly polyvalent and flexible notions that can really, you know, render insightful the political dynamics of a very diverse situation. So I'm personally a very big fan of these two notions in his work.
Same here, if I may add that. And it would really say you can make a very strong argument to people in political science who have never dealt with discourse theory at all. And they might be inclined to see the value of these logics because they're very simple, parsimonious even, you might say, but also, as Thomas has mentioned, very, very flexible and very, they're universal enough to be particular at the same time. And I think this is a very good way how to analyze political processes, like these many examples you just mentioned, Thomas. And if I might add that anecdote, another one from meeting Laclau, once I was just asking him, PhD student, and I was so, okay, what can I do with the theory? I like it. I love it. Okay, well, but my PhD supervisor, he was not at all invested in post-structuralist theory data. You know that. So I thought, okay, I got to convince him by doing some empirical work. And I was just asking, Monsieur Laclau, Ernesto, what do you think about doing empirical work? And he said, I love empirical work. So, yeah, get on with it. And I just, very bad English, tried to explain him what I was trying to do with the terrorism and drug prohibition discourse. And he was just like, yeah, sure. That sounds obvious. Yeah, logic of equivalence and difference. And I was so reassured. And I was like, oh, God, that was really nice. But it shows... that's a totally different type of argument I'm making here. It's more about the theory and how far it can also make to see you things you haven't seen before, which is always a good thing if you have to write a PhD.
Let's conclude a bit this section of our discussion on the two logics. While rereading Laclau and what he was writing about them, my feeling was that he was really preferring the logic of difference and that the logic of difference was more appropriate for democratic politics. That was my reading. What do you think?
I think, Dana, that you've really identified something super important there in and allow me to be critical of Laclau and move here for a second, in that indeed they propose these concepts and then they sometimes run a little bit too much with them, I think. In Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, the 1985 book, they propose this logic of equivalence and difference, and they're incredibly powerful concepts. And then somehow, you know, instead of being content with having proposed these concepts, somehow the entire notion of democratic politics then needs to be, you know, equated with the logic of difference. And indeed, you know, this kind of, in the context of Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, casts the logic of difference as the good one, because it's the one, you know, that comprises democratic politics. And I think that this is a completely unnecessary overstretching of their argument, if I may be critical of them for a second. And then, you know, 20 years later, Laclau writes his book on populist reason. And in these 20 years, his research interest has kind of shifted from Marxism, democracy. You know, he no longer writes books together with MOVE, even if I'm sure they still got along super, super well. He has started to focus more on populism, and populism is basically the incarnation, the deployment of the logic of equivalence, according to Laclau, happens through populism. And suddenly the logic of equivalence has become, and I quote, the royal road towards understanding politics. Suddenly, you know, populism is politics, is hegemony. Suddenly, you know, all politics has become populism. Suddenly, the logic of equivalence is the one that completely captures how politics work. Suddenly, the logic of equivalence is the good one. And I think, again, this is a slight overstretching of the concept. Populism is an incredibly interesting political strategy. It can be a very powerful one, much like antagonism can be a very powerful one, etc., etc. But it's not the only one. It's not the royal road. And I think this is another case of Laclau and Mouffe having proposed a very powerful concept and then running with it slightly too much.
Perhaps this also relates to one of the criticism that has been made by Simon Critchley and others on the normative aspects or the normative commitments of a discourse theory. I think of the Laclau reader of early 2004, if I remember correctly, within which there was a strong discussion about this issue of whether there is a sort of normative undercurrent in the theory that has not been worked out or spelled out openly. What you just described, Thomas, you could also align it with the way the world was then and is today, right? So the time they've been writing hegemonian socialist strategy and new reflections on the revolution, so of time, the logic of difference appeared to be tied to democracy, obviously, because it was the high time of democracy. And on the other hand, as you just said, later on, 20 years, it was all about populism because we witnessed the rise of various populist movements. And that's what I think is interesting about them. Laclau has always been a theorist of his time. But I think this normative issue hasn't been solved. So if any of the listeners feel tempted to, go for it.
Okay, great. I want to like come back to the topic of hegemony in some ways, and obviously that is a central concept in Laclau and Mouffe's work, and has been like used by various thinkers throughout the 20th century. So this is perhaps the question of all questions in this episode of our podcast: what is hegemony, and is a state of hegemony equivalent to hegemonic discourse?
This is an absolutely wonderful question. I kind of prepared a slightly poetic answer in the sense that I think hegemony is everything. When we decide to walk on the pavement, it's hegemony. When we go to work, that's hegemony. When we make ourselves tea in the afternoon, that's hegemony at work. These are seemingly day-to-day activities, and yet they have become so normalized, so commonsensical. When we think of politics in America as being between the Republicans and the Democrats, that's hegemony. When we think of, you know, Belgian politics, and Belgian myself, as being dysfunctional, Belgium never has a government. All of these stereotypes, these forms of common sense, these completely normalized ideas, that's hegemony. In the sense that these social states, these social facts, are in a way highly political. They're highly contingent. It could be completely different. It could be completely opposite of what it is now. You know, it could be that in a city there is in fact this teeny tiny space reserved for cars, and all of the rest of the space is given to pedestrians and bikes. That could be the case. That's very well imaginable. But we all find it very, very normal and very, very commonsensical that 80% of the space in the city is given to cars. There could very well be room in American politics for a strong labor movement, for a strong, you know, properly left-wing force. And yet we find it very normal that it's not there. So for me, hegemony is in a way this very, you know, the very mechanism through which what is normal, what is commonsensical, is reified as normal and commonsensical. And the process through which it loses its contingent origins. Now, to rebound to your question of, you know, is a state of hegemony equivalent to a hegemonic discourse? I would be inclined to say yes, in the sense that hegemonies are always discursive in nature. There is nothing natural or inherent or given about their existence. They don't rise spontaneously. They need to be constructed and reproduced and maintained in the way we think and in the way we act and in the way we speak and in the way we behave. And because of that, I think we can think of hegemonies as necessarily being discursive, having discursive origins.
Actually, I can only agree and say, yeah, that's basically it. Perhaps to add, I mean, it's worth noting that hegemonies, they are somehow, they imagine themselves as representing a project, democracy, capitalism, or whatever, to the full. But it is also like something Derrida has once remarked, they are always à venir, they're always to come. So, which makes somehow, as Thomas has so nicely aligned, they are so normal, they appear so, so stable and so strong on a strong impact on our everyday lives. But on the other hand, there is always a measure of them to be questioned and to overthrow them in a way. Climate change would be one thing. As you mentioned, cars, right? How we all discuss about phasing out all fuel-based cars. I don't know whether this is the correct term, but they have been there for decades. There are many people who can't imagine of not driving a car, of not having cars in the street. So, and that's, I think, the perfidy of hegemonies in a way, that they make things appear so normal. They might dull our senses. So that's part of their dark side, if that is the dark side of hegemonies. They all have, irrespective whether we would say they are normatively a good thing.
And I think this follow-up question is absolutely necessary here. Who creates this normality? Who is responsible for it? Laclau is no longer a Marxist, or he distanced himself from Marxism. In Marxism, at least, we had a historical agent. We had a social class. We had the working class. But in post-Marxist politics, we don't have it anymore. We are in a state of hegemony. We inhabit it. It's our new normal. But who brought it about? Thomas, you discuss at quite some length in your book the concept of political strategy. Eva has worked on it as well. How exactly is this helpful to us? How did it help you in your analysis of European politics?
I think part of the strength of Laclau's move beyond the class agent, beyond class structures as the prime mechanism for social change, is that it clearly opens up the strategic question in all of its, you know, in all of its depth. Imagine thinking about, you know, the various political strategies that we can pursue to achieve social change. There's a whole range of different strategies at our disposal. And now imagine that there is a precondition that any strategy that we might deploy in the pursuit of social change has to have the working class as its prime actor, as its prime agent. I would say that the majority of the political strategies to pursue social change that we have at our disposal suddenly have disappeared from our reservoir, from our arsenal, from the toolkit that we have at our disposal to pursue social change. And I think what Laclau and Mouffe do in hegemony and socialist strategy by decentering the class agent is in fact doing Marxism an incredible favor, in the sense that we still have, I think, in Laclau, the ethos of Marxism. We still have the goals of Marxism. We still have the, you know, aspirations of Marxism. And in that sort of sense, I think we can still think of Laclau as a Marxist. He's still somebody who dreams, who fights for a better world, except he no longer does so in a stereotypical fashion that was designed by a man with a long beard in the 19th century. He says, let's think about all of the various strategic options that we have at our disposal. Let's, you know, look at the entire range of strategies that we have at our disposal, not just the ones that involve the working class. And of course, the working class still plays a role in Laclaurian theory, in the sense that working class is a subject position around which various political strategies can revolve. But it is not the only one. And I think in my book, I arrive at the conclusion that this sort of creates a division of labor within critical theory, in the sense that we have certain critical theories, such as Marxism, which think about what forms of social change are desirable, what forms of social change will create a better world, which economic changes are necessary, which changes to the way we imagine the concept of gender and the notion of gender are necessary to create a better world, a more desirable world. And then post-Marxism, a la Laclau, it is charged with the question of, all right, having arrived at the conclusion that we want this form of social change, how do we achieve it? How can we most successfully pursue it? And so I like to think of Laclau and Mouffe as still being Marxist, but being Marxist primarily concerned with the question of political strategy.
Yeah, I think my hunch is, or as I read Laclau in particular, not Mouffe, but Laclau in particular, is that he very much, he left aside these questions of class and Marxism and social change for quite a couple of publications. It was, I would say, emancipation and the normative issues have been recurrently occupied him, but not to the extent like political strategies or the various logics and the role of the subject, in particular in the 1990s. So for me, they are post-Marxists to the bone, to the core. And I think in contrast to a number of other critical discourse analysts like Fairclough, Ruth Wodak, and the like, this project of political change or social change has not been so prominent to them. It has more been, for me, translated via this idea of, let's put it very bluntly, fending off populism. Giving, so to say, even activists the strategy to counter populism. So it's more this kind of, I see them more in this respect of their, in particular, Laclau's interest in the last years. But as I said, that's my reading, and I think it's perfectly nice to have these two versions of it, because both offer multiple points of contact at the one hand, and different points of where you can jump off into different topics and have your own political analysis, which is, proves again how viable a theory it is.
Okay, let's bring this discussion to a conclusion and think about the future and what Laclau's thinking can offer us for any sort of future imagination and future hope for democracy. What would be your reactions?
So I think what makes Laclau powerful is that, if I may quote the Lord of the Rings here for a moment, there is always hope. But neither can we be too optimistic. Laclau is also not a classic Marxist in the sense that he thinks change will be delivered to us, through the very machinations of, how the economy works. The revolution is not inevitable either. I think what Laclau and Mouffe teaches is that social change, the revolution, emancipation, call it whatever you want, it is to be won by, by political struggle, through political struggle, through political construction. Change is socially constructed, and we have to go out and realize it. And so in this sort of sense, I think that if you think from Laclau and Mouffe's perspective, hope for social change can never be extinguished, because the social can never be fully closed. And so there will always be potential avenues towards social change. But we cannot rest on our laurels and think that change will just be delivered to us, you know, by virtue of the crisis of neoliberalism, by virtue of the crisis of late capitalism, by virtue of the omni-crisis, change will automatically happen. We can never, ever believe that. So I think Black Lives Move give us hope, but they also give us the task of pursuing this hope, of realizing this hope, and of making, you know, change happen.
And I would say they with the category of a demand, they are also calling on us to raise demands and to try to, yeah, to unite, to build chains of equivalence with regard to specific demands that might foster democratic and social change. And they also, and that's what I think I like also about the theory, is that they also highlight that these logics are not reserved for democratic politics or for Democrats or for people with good intentions. They also highlight that, for instance, those we call the bad guys, the terrorists, the drug dealers, et cetera, you name it, that they also, yeah, somehow establish their relations of dominations via the idea of hegemony and the logic of difference and equivalence. And I think that's why there is hope, because the theory teaches us, though there is no beyond, it tells us things can be obscured, and you can, looking underneath is not the very best formulation in this sense, but it is about realizing that hegemonic formations, these relations of domination, of uniting people in a political consensus, as temporary as it might be, is also a way of avoiding questions and perhaps even silencing questions, depending on where you live. And I think that's the thing that you can see with them. And this might, and here I agree with Thomas finally, that there is also hope in these, in realizing that there are strategies available to come to terms with that.
Eva, Thomas, thank you very much for joining us in our discussion on Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe's landmark book, Hegemony and Socialist Strategy Towards a Radical Democratic Politics. It's very difficult to end a discussion, so I would like to paraphrase Laclau and say the discussion is still open. And to our listeners, please join us again for our next episode here on Critically Linked. Thank you very much for listening to us.